general topic for today is the Azuma problem, and in particular the problem of the recalcitrant husband, the Baal Hamasare Ligaris. The Azuma problem is certainly not a new one by any means. We have references to the problem of the Azuma and to proposals for the amelioration of the Azuma problem in the Gemara. Kol Einay Dafikoto, Einay Elatoya. And why wasn't Dafikoto the Afeita? Because Kol Hayeshim, Lachem Esbeis Dodi, Get Krisus are basically Ishtay. And the Get Krisus wasn't to prevent Dodi from committing an Aveira. The Get Krisus was to prevent the problem of an Aguna as a result of a husband not coming home from war and there not being sufficient evidence to be matir, this woman who's the Peskos HaShishi, to remarry. Clearly, in the time of Chazal, the problem was the problem associated with warfare. And they looked for ways and means to deal with it. Actually, I shouldn't say the time of Chazal, but in the time of David HaMelech, it was Chazal was simply reporting what took place in the time of David HaMelech, and the way that they resolved the problem was with a get. Machlokes Rashi faces, was it an absolute get? Was it a get al tanai? But in one way or another, they arranged for a get in order to eliminate the problem of the aguna, so that even if in Tim Solema the husband was still alive, the woman would be a grusha, either a grusha that there is badai, because she was a negureshes from the time that the husband went to war, or she became a negureshes as a result of the condition that was attached to it, with a conditional get, which then afterwards became a get lemafreya. Interestingly enough, we have sources indicating that this did not originate in the time of David HaMelech. There is an interesting Baal HaTurim and Kumish on the process of Negod of Meruven, Chalutzim Tatu Bismay Acheichem. The Baal HaTurim says that the word Chalutzim is conventionally translated as arms, correct? Chalutzim Tatu Bismay Acheichem, you will go before your brothers with arms, as soldiers, armed soldiers. The Baal HaTurim says that the word Chalutzim is the same as the word or the phrase Beit Chalutz Hana'al, that these people who went to war were called Chalutzim because they did something to obviate the need of the Chalitzas Hana'al, did something to prevent the need for Chalitzas. In order to eliminate the problem of evil, the people who went to war, even the time of Moshe, or at least the time of Yeshua, Chalutzim Tavim Achetem, is Nochemes Yeshua at the very minimum, they wrote a Get Krisus, just as was the case later in the Kol HaYeshu Mochemes Yisdavim. In other words, the Baal HaTurim is saying it wasn't the innovation of David, that this was already part of the Messiah from Moshe Rabbeinu, because it was practiced, or even Moshe practiced it himself, or we don't know, Mochemes Nidyon. They tried to get Krisus before they went out. But at least in the Mochemes Yeshua, Moshe was telling them that they go to Meruvain, that they should write a Get Krisus before they go out to Mochemes Yeshua. So that aspect of the Aguna problem is an ancient problem, and the remedy is equally ancient, although there are problems with the remedy. There are problems that arose only in later periods of history, problems that arise in the earlier periods, and we'll see a little bit later. So that in the Tkufat HaMikro, the problem was clearly a problem of Milchoma, and the Aguna situation resulted from the fact that there wasn't sufficient evidence to be matir, the widow, to remarry. Later in the Tkufat HaMishnah, you find a different kind of Aguna problem, and I'm being very broad in general, obviously. The later problems existed earlier, the earlier problems existed later. I don't intend to be historical. I'm speaking in terms of, quote, the literature, close quote. You find the concerns reflected in the recorded material.
In the Tkufas HaMishneh, you find Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Tzoris and Mayim She'en Lahem Tzoris, and all the problems that arise with regard to the Heter Aguna, and there it's clear that the problems are essentially with regard to wayfarers, travelers, Kol HaDrochim B'Pesach HaSakana, and Yerdei HaYom clearly were a sakana from the very beginning, and people went on trips and didn't come back. It wasn't a joking matter in those days by any means. People just didn't come back when they went on trips, and there was no evidence to be matter of the woman, and we have all of these problems from the Gedorim of Halacha, under what circumstances can she marry, what circumstances can she marry, etc., etc. Later, in the Tkufa of Rishonim, in the medieval period, the tshuvas that are written seem to deal almost entirely with the problem of a get shchid meira. And the shchid meira was a problem not of evidence to be matir the woman as an almone. The shchid meira on the deathbed, and the chevra kedisha are going to come, and everybody's going to identify the corpse, and we know he's dead. Only the problem is that there's a brother living someplace at a distance, and the brother is not available for chlitza, or there is concern that he will not give chlitza for one reason or for another. So that in this kufa of the Rishonim during this medieval period, most of the diyunim deal with the get shchid meira, how to execute the get, whether to execute the get, etc., etc., etc. Including even tshuvas with regard to what you can do, some of the things on Shabbos, etc. In any event, by the time we get to the Shulchan Aruch, we're dealing with a similar problem, but a slightly different problem. Here, the problem becomes not a shchid meira, and not yerdei drachim, and not yerdei hayom or yerdei drachim, and not mochoma. The problem suddenly becomes a husband who is a mumer, and even more frequently, apparently, a brother who is a mumer. Historically, there was a period of Rahman Watlan apostasy and shmad. People, for a variety of reasons, were becoming mishimodim, and the result is that this became a very serious problem. On occasion, the husband became a mishumid and refused to divorce his wife. Even more frequently, or at least more frequently in terms of the problems that arose, the husband may have been a fine Yerei Shemayim, but he had a brother who was a mumer, and when he died, the brother wouldn't give chlitza. So you find the references to the problems of the Ach Mumer, and a little bit later, not in times of Shulchan Aruch, but mainly in Vayishayin, the same resolutions were considered. When you had the brother who wasn't a mumer, but the brother who went to this far-off country called America or Africa, South Africa. That's a little bit later. It's after the Kufa of the Shulchan Aruch, but 200 years later, you have the problems with the brother who's not necessarily a mumer, but he went off to America, and I suspect that in some minds, the two were not only functionally equivalent, but may have been regarded as equivalent in more ways as well. And here, in this kufa, you suddenly find the proposal of a Mari Greiner at Kiddushin Al-Tnai. Kiddushin Al-Tnai was the response to the problem of an Ach Mumer. The other ways that the problem had been resolved in earlier periods would not help in the case of an Ach Mumer, and you have the earliest proposal for Kiddushin Al-Tnai, which at least 3 years ago I was told is handled in some other session, and I'm not supposed to be talking about Kiddushin Al-Tnai. In any event, Kiddushin Al-Tnai is supposed to be handled in some other week. Somebody else? Maybe we'll talk a little bit about it later. Then, the next Kufa, or the next chapter in the Aguna problem, occurs after the period of the French Revolution. It occurs after the historical epoch in which Jews were granted civil liberty, and now the Aguna problem assumes a different guise. It becomes the problem of the Baal HaMasar of Lagarish, the problem of the Baal Sarvan. With the exception of things like World War II and the Dakar submarine, yeah, there are occasionally problems where you don't have proper aid lists in order to be monitoring a woman whose husband has gotten lost. But those aren't my scene before viewing today, fortunately.
Sorry?
What submarine?
Dakar. When the Israeli submarine, 20 years ago, it sank. I mean, these passions, unfortunately, whatever happens, unfortunately, even this one Agun out there is terrible. But these classic Aguna problems do not arise with any degree of frequency today. The Maisin Bokol Yain is the Baal HaMasara of Lagari, whom I will talk about a little bit and will spend most of the day dealing with the recalcitrant husband, this Baal HaMasara of Lagari. Let me just try to explain a little bit, if it needs explanation. Let me try to explain why this is a problem, why the others aren't a problem today, we know. But why is this a problem today when it wasn't a problem once upon a time? Yes? Why isn't the problem of a husband going to war a problem today? First of all, Baruch Hashem, war is not as frequent today as it is once upon a time. Secondly, how many MIAs are there left from Vietnam? The world. How many MIAs are left from Vietnam? How many people in the course of the Israeli war, there were, if my figures are correct, 1,710 casualties, deaths of Israeli soldiers from 1948 until today? How many soldiers disappeared and have bodies have not been recovered? How many Agunas are there in Eretz Yisrael today? The answer, as far as the Agunas are concerned, again, I cannot vouch for this. I am told that there are zero Agunas in Eretz Yisrael as a result of war. Now, there are some men who came back whose bodies were not recovered. But the Dakar, who wasn't war, the submarine sank, but the Israeli Yisrael were not there, the women, on the basis of whatever. Yeah? We're not dealing with Agunas in general. Shouldn't be a guy in Mehmezin. If I remember it, five volumes of Eser HaBeskin on Heter Agun, one sinner. That's the classic Aguna problem. You need evidence to be not there, the woman, and that time, first of all, the frequency is not that great today, because today you bring back the body. In fact, in Eretz Yisrael, and here I'm not going to either, I make no comment about the propriety, one way or the other, so let me take it either way, but the Israeli army is known, and it's part of the rules and regulations of Israeli warfare. Soldiers are meiser nefesh. They put themselves in danger to recover bodies. Now, prima facie, no business like that. Gvurat Hanes is not a reason to put yourself in the sakon. They claim that they do it because of morale, etc., etc., and that it would lead to the Gvurat Hanes if the other soldiers would become aware of the fact that their bodies may not be brought back. I don't know if they're worried about their lives and not doing this, they're worried about other things, but in the real world, the bodies are brought back. And when they aren't brought back, and given the conditions in which we live today, it's possible to get the evidence that's necessary to be mapped to the Aguna. That wasn't the case once upon a time. And that's why the Maisin Bokol Yoin, the problem, are this Baal HaMasara of the gallery. He's perfectly fine and healthy. We can find it. He just won't do anything after we find it. I'm sorry? The Israelis do not write a get of not. Again, I don't want to defend it or to attack it. They don't write a get of Tnai for what they claim are psychological reasons. I want to talk about other things. I'm not sure that there aren't two sides to that question. I'm not sure that if somebody were to ask me for my opinion that on balance I wouldn't advise a get of Tnai, but it is not done. Now, there are problems with the get off night, and the problems with the get off night, we'll see in a moment, may be such that you will not have accomplished terribly much if you do write a get off night. I'll say a few words about that a little bit later. Let me talk about first why there's a problem with Baal HaMasara of Lagari today, and why there is no problem of Baal HaMasara, or was a problem of Baal HaMasara of Lagari once upon a time. It would be very nice to be able to say that because once upon a time,
time, everyone, all people were Uranian flaming, and nobody would allow his wife to be in such a position, and everyone did exactly what the Rav or the Beis Din told them to do, and the result is that there was no Baal HaMagar, Sar Vagaris. That would be very nice. It's a highly romanticized picture of Jewish history. There was no problem of Baal HaMagar Vagaris for a number of historical legal reasons. And it's necessary to know that Jews during the entire medieval period occupied a rather peculiar, and I don't use that word with negative connotations, these are the sense of unique. They occupied a rather unique position. Their status legally was that of servi camerae, serfs of the chamber. They were owned, in quotation marks, directly by the king or by the feudal lord. They were described in the literature as an imperium in imperio, as a nation within a nation. This has survived to the very day in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, in which of the 14 nationalities, there is only one that doesn't really have a national homeland, Gruzinistan, which is a political and legal fiction. The internal passport stamp in Gruzinistan indicates simply that Jews were regarded as a people, even though they did not have jurisdiction over any sovereign territory. They were regarded as an ethnically identifiable group, and this had a great number of legal ramifications. In effect, this led to a kind of autonomy in many areas of law, not necessarily having to do with these institutions. During the medieval period, the notion that is a fiction. It's not true. Maybe the halakha of Dalmisus Bezin is lawful. But Jews executed criminals well into the medieval period. Not like it's for shame, but it was possible to do so. How and on what basis they did so isn't our problem today. But there's a Shulchan Aruch. He went from Germany to Spain, and he saw them doing it in Spain, and he held the halakha was incorrect, but instead of being Meisa, he refused to be Meisa, and said that they had on whom to be famous, because the Chachmei Svarad were prepared to endorse the practice. The only way that you could do this was because Jews were granted a very, very high degree of judicial autonomy. In some jurisdictions, it extended to criminal matters. In some jurisdictions, the Jews actually executed. In others, they pronounced the sentence and handed them over to the civil executioner who did the dirty work. But in all jurisdictions, Jews had autonomy with regard to matters of family law. That survived to this very day in one country in the world called the State of Israel. The Malay system was inherited from the Ottoman Mandate, was preserved by the British, and entered into Israeli law. The autonomy of the Bote Din Rabbonim is not because of halacha, and has nothing to do with recognition of the Jewish family law as the law of the state. The same recognition is granted, lahavdil, to Muslims, to Christians of different stripes and denominations, to the extent that there are some Christian denominations who have no laws of divorce and had to go write them in order to execute divorces for their own adherents in Medinat Yisrael, because there is no civil divorce in Medinat Yisrael. This notion that every ethnic and religious group has autonomy in these matters was common in the medieval period, survived the Ottoman Empire, and survives to this day in the Israeli legal system. What this meant was that until the French Revolution, there was no notion of a civil divorce. Divorce, marriage, etc., was handled only by the various religious groups, and for the most part, these groups were allowed to do as they pleased. In Tsarist Russia, before the Communist Revolution, there were only two groups of people who were permitted divorce, the Greek Orthodox Church in Russia. The Russian Orthodox Church, like the Greek Orthodox, refused to permit divorce. The only people who were entitled to divorce were Muslims and Jews.
In Great Britain, until 1865, roughly, the Anglican Church did not recognize divorce, or at least there was no divorce in England as either an ecclesiastic act or as a judicial act on the part of the court. There was divorce in England after the Reformation, but it was only by act of Parliament, and this was something that occurred only in very, very rare instances. Jews executed Gittin in England during that entire period. It was only in the 1920s that a British parliamentary commission began conducting inquiries for whatever reason, and you had learned jurists appearing before the commission debating whether the Bezden of London really had authority in the early 1800s to do all of this or not. So the 1920s, they're arguing whether the Jews were entitled to do it, but de facto, the Jews were doing it, and nobody thought to prevent them from doing so. So that Jews during this period had autonomy in matters of family law. Now, this meant that there was no way in the world that a person could leave his wife and enter into a new marital relationship without the approval of the local royal or the local bezden. The only way that a person could establish a new marital relationship was Kedat Meshav Yisrael. As long as he was a member of the Jewish community, this was absolutely the only way that he could do it, and therefore he had a great impetus to execute again. In addition, there were other certain socioeconomic sanctions that could be applied, not the least of which was the power of Kerem, and you couldn't cross the color line very easily. You couldn't just blend into society without actually becoming a Mishumi. It's only after the French Revolution and the Enlightenment that Jews acquired civil liberties, but with it they lost certain privileges. They lost autonomy in most European jurisdictions with regard to matters of family law, as a result of which a person could avail himself of what was called la marie. He could get a civil divorce and get a civil marriage license. He could go off and do whatever he liked, and nobody could do very much about it. Not only that, but since he now had civil liberties, he could leave the walls of the ghetto and conduct his life as he chose, and didn't have to be terribly concerned with whatever sanctions might be brought to bear upon him by the Jewish community. So that you can understand why the Gedolei Yisrael of the time weren't terribly enthusiastic about liberté, égalité, et fraternité. The liberty and equality nail it, but this this fraternité, this acceptance was a bit much. They paid a price for it, and they recognized that there was a very high price to be paid for it. And the price that we pay is the problem of the Baal HaMasari Lagarish. Tshuva dealing with this arrives only after that period, because it's only from that period this becomes a problem. So that most... Yes?
What about the
For the Ottoman law, for the most part...
Let's say non-Ottoman areas, like the
pretty much. There were, remember, there weren't terribly many places outside of the areas we've spoken of that had significant Jewish population. North Africa, for the most part, was governed much the same way, and you didn't have Jews in the Congo. Yes.
What's the social program
There may well have been, but divorce still existed, and you didn't have a problem with the Messiah of Lagarish. There may have been fewer instances of divorce, yes, so that statistically you're bound to have fewer cases of divorce, hence fewer chances for somebody to get. That may well be true, but there was still significant opprobrium attached to divorce after the French Revolution until you get well into the 20th century. The opprobrium associated with divorce, or the absence thereof, the metamorphosis is something that has occurred in your lifetime, not to speak of mine. Let me then go to the various solutions that have been proposed with regard to the problem. The first solution is a solution that I'm not supposed to be talking about, and that's Kiddushin Al Tanai, conditional marriage. A marriage that is to be conditioned upon the dissolution of the marriage by a civil court, usually as these things were formulated, stating that if within a certain period after the entry of a civil decree, if there was no get to that measure of soil, then the marriage is to be regarded as null and void retroactively. This was the proposal of a French rabbi whose name was Brother Khan in the early 20th century, roughly 1905 or thereabouts. This was his proposal for Kiddushin al-Tanai. This evoked a series of responses which were collected and published in a little monograph called Ein Tanai Kiddushin. I think that part of that has been reproduced in this package, or at least part of it was supposed to be reproduced in this package. You'll find there short little items by the Arsenea, by the Achiezer, even a little piece from Chaim Brisker, all opposing the innovation of Kiddushin al-Tanai. Incidentally, this is just curiosity. A lot of people didn't even understand what it is this man was proposing. There is one short little tshuva by the chief rabbi of Holland at the time, who thought that Sotah Khan was proposing the acceptance of a civil decree, and talks about the Mishnah Gittin of Dorothy and Bakari Falakim, Kushmikite Nosin, and doesn't understand how all of this can happen. But we'll do that as it may, it's not terribly significant. What is significant is that there was a proposal that the marriage be regarded as null and void retroactively whenever there is dissolution of the marriage by a civil court. Those proposals were knocked down for a number of different reasons, the primary reason, the most significant reason being that all of this involved a situation in which there is a presumption in terms of halacha that if the parties preclude after the immediately of a shliach, that there is a veto of the shlichus for the execution of the get, that the people are cohabiting, they're cohabiting for purposes of marriage, and there is no longer a desire on the part of the husband for a divorce. There were other problems as well, particularly when these were conditioned upon the entry of a decree by a civil court. This then involves us in problems of rerum. It's contingent upon the action or the failure to act of other individuals, and that leads to a problem with regard to the validity of the shlichus in the first place. This proposal was resurrected in modern times by Eliezer Berkowitz. It's not my topic, so I'm not going to talk about it. I just must say that I have gone through his little work on this a number of times. I cannot, for the life of me, see how in any way any of the different formulations, and we have several of them in the book, I can't see how any of these differ in a significant way from the original proposal of Sotah Khan. That's not my observation. I think in this package you have something from Rav Kasher, an excerpt from something that appeared in Noam. In effect, Rav Kasher said that he doesn't see how Berkowitz's proposal is different from the French proposal, and whatever objections there were to the French proposal, those objections pertain with equal force to the Berkowitz proposal. It's one of the few times when I find myself in agreement with Rav Kasher. The second proposal, which I shoot, yes? No, that's inaccurate. It is accurate that Rav Weinberg wrote a Haskama to the Sefer, and it is also accurate that he opposed the proposal. I find no contradiction in those two positions, particularly in light of the fact that anybody who's ever read a Haskama knows that the general text of a Haskama is, this man brought me a work, I know the man, a very fine person, I had glanced at the book, and since I have so many other duties, I couldn't go through it very carefully, but I'm sure that on the basis of the little that I've read, the rest must be like what I've read, and I know the person, Chazor, Chalfavre, etc., etc., therefore, it would be a good idea if you buy the book. That's a typical Haskalah. And that doesn't mean that either you agree to everything in the book or that you have even read the book. So I do not find it terribly surprising to hear that Rabbi Weinberg afterwards took a position diametrically opposed to the position which is espoused in the book. But I can't address the question. I can only deal with what's in print. I'm not interested in Teresh about that. I can only deal with Teresh of itself. And I can only deal with what we have. And again, Kedushin al-Tanai is not the topic for today, although I'll talk a little bit more about it later. The second proposal, or the second device that was proposed as a means of dealing with it, was a shivua, an oath to be sworn by the chosen at the time of the wedding, to the effect that under the appropriate conditions, and you can fill in the blanks, he will not refuse to execute a get kedas Moshe the Yisrael. There are two problems with this. The first is a practical problem. It's true that Kol Olam is Daza when the Rebbeinu Shloim gave the commandment of Leisitha, but the world made it tremble. But I suspect that the typical Baal HaMestarev Lagarej would not be seized with fear and trepidation if you told him that he is now over on the shura that he took the time that he got married. That would be unlikely to convince him that you could get, or at least in many such cases it would be unlikely to be persuasive, so that in our day and age it's not a panacea, it's not going to solve all of these problems. The second is that we're dealing with a more serious problem, a problem of halacha, which will be germane with regard to some of the other problems, and we may as well address it here, and that's the problem of Ein Tzur D'Nafshe. At every Sidur Haget, there is something very similar to Hatoras Nedarim on Erev Rosh Hashanah. You ask the husband if he has taken an oath, either to give the get or not to give the get, and of course he says no. And then you tell him, well, in case you did, but you forgot about it, would you like us to be vatal that shua? And of course he says yes. And then you go through a people shua and a chorus nedarim, the whole process. Now, what's the purpose of all of this? And it's not only to be mocked in the shua, he says he wouldn't give the get. It's the shua to give the get, which are also mevatel. What's the purpose of being mevatel the shua to give the get? He's doing it. Who cares? The reason for doing that is that we have a problem of Ein Tzur D'Nafshe. The general principle is that a get is valid only if it is given by the individual of his own free will. If there is any coercion, if there is any duress, the get is not valid, with the exception of cases in which the halacha is crazy nice yes. Shiyei Bereisami, and those we'll talk a little bit later. Yes? Yes, I'm not talking about people in such a race on it. That to me is perfectly fine. In cases where Bezdin has the power of Sphia, is based upon the assumption that A, Mitzvah Shemar Divrei Chachamim, B, everybody wants to do what the Chachamim tell him to do. The Rambam, the famous Rambam, that there's there are in effect two wills. There's an inner will, and then there's the Yetzer Hara superimposed upon it. The inner will really wants to do what he's supposed to do. Everybody wants to be a tzaddik, it's just the Yetzer Hara that gets in the way. The problem is that we've got to deal with the Yetzer Hara, because Ratzon means the Ratzon of the Yetzer Hara also. But the Yetzer Hara is subject to all kinds of influences. The Yetzer Hara operates on a pleasure-pain principle. The Yetzer Hara is hedonistic. So that if the Chachamim say you're supposed to give a get, and this guy doesn't want to give a get, it's either because his wife is a good cook and he doesn't want to miss her culinary delight, or because he derives certain other pleasure, physical in nature, from the marriage, or he gets some kind of perverse pleasure out of causing her pain, and all of that is the Sahara, that's superficial. So we'll apply a vector force operating in the opposite direction. We'll apply a little pain. The pain will cancel out the pleasure. We've neutralized the Sahara, and now this inner will can make itself manifest. That's the principle of Kriyasamrita Achimura Sanding, and it's valid only when there is this inner will. This mitzvah, lishmaya divrei chacham, what divrei chacham means, that there is a mitzvah of one kind or another, has nothing to do with him, but the mitzvah the Torah has imposed upon him. She's a Grushin, he's a Kohen, or he's a mamzer, he's not allowed to marry her. And now Bezin is going to be kriyasa ligaresh, they're being kriyasa to him to do what the Torah tells him to do. And that's really what he wants to do anyway. This kind of general will that has absolutely nothing to do with individual's preference, you find mirrored in Rousseau, the volonté générale. Now he talks about the general rule of society, so the Rambam is not a general rule of society, but you know, the Rukh Hapnimi of the individual, this is the pure, pristine will of the person. The problem of Ein Sod in Nafshe is that sure, the individual has now generated a situation in which there is a new mitzvah and he's got to fulfill his shurut, but the Torah never told him to make the shurut in the first place. He has imposed the conditions of duress on himself. It's self-coercion, the coin of bread. He is coercing himself. This Ein Sod in Nafshe is the subject of Machlokes Rishonim. The Rambam in Ibn Ezra says that we recognize Ein Sod in Nafshe as a form of fear that can interfere with the liberty of the get. B'dieved, the get is kosher. But no Bezin wants to be misogynistic again on the basis of even Ein Sod in Nafshe. Therefore, this annulment of the Shavuot, which may be prompting him to act as the vaccine, namely to give the get. Therefore, we eliminate the Shavuot, we've eliminated the Ein Sod in Nafshe. Yes.
So
we just have
no
question.
What's the
question?
So
what?
The lesser is there because he admits it, but we
can't
force it. So
it's just
using
the
relation.
Right? This is the answer to the Nafshe, right? The answer to the Nafshe, which the Diyeved, the Get, is perfectly valid. Your point is that the Mokum Igun discerned the Chand of the Diyeved. Good, fine. That means there may be a great deal of cogency in the position. The problem is that if you're looking for a solution, then you want the solution that isn't the B'dieta. That makes this a less favorable solution than some of the others that are available.
Why is it again, we can't set the act, we want the act to be down, and the Shavuot binding on cases where he admits them, just like when they didn't cope with it, so that they don't have the power to see it.
I'm not at all concerned about cases where the halakha is taken in a section of the Rishon. There are many cases out there of the Balaam style of the Garish where there are no grounds for kriya. Now let me say a word or two about grounds for kriya. First of all, we in this country or in the rest of the Western world don't have police power at all. There's no way that we can be kriya. Now sure, it might be a form of kriya, fine. But general police power doesn't exist. It does exist in one little geographic area, and it's called Medinat Yisrael. There the Bosei Din have a power of fear. If the dead issues a psak in the fear and the Baal doesn't want to divorce his wife, they call the police and the guy goes into jail. Technically it's similar to contempt of court. The Bezin said do, and he didn't do, so he goes to court. The instances in which the Bezin Din has popped in fear in the last 43 years, is it 43 exactly? You can count on the fingers of not one hand but of two hands. If you take two hands, you'll have a few fingers left over. There are a number of people languishing in the Israeli jails right now because they have refused to fulfill the staff of the Beis Din, including one Taimani who claims that life in jail is far better than life outside. So why in the world should he avoid his life? He's been there, I think, for something like 20 years. Now, the point I'm trying to illustrate is that Bosei Din, for whatever reason, and that's for some other session, not for here, are reluctant, perhaps notoriously so, are reluctant to pass Din's fear. Now, why doesn't this
in some cases, or to some extent, it's because they're afraid of being fooled, the evidence, no, public center rallying. For another case, it's because of shoshes and machlokes among upbringing, etc., etc. The result is that except in very, very clear-cut cases where there's no dispute and the facts are well established, the Brotekin simply don't pass and see it. And if the Brotekin don't pass and see it, then you've got a problem. Yeah, as a man sir gets married, you know, and he took a shavua to give his wife a gift, if they have a civil divorce, under those circumstances, I don't think that the Bezdin would hold the shavua against them. It's taking their session a race on it, so it's an incident actually he's doing because of the shavua, not because he had a policeman with a whip in his hand, and in that case, the tzvi wouldn't bother the Bezdin at all. The only Zanashe wouldn't bother the Bezdin at all. But, you know, though that's not the typical case that we're dealing with. The typical case, incidentally, involves a situation in which in Halakha, it's far, far from certain that the woman is entitled to a gift. Only, when you say Harabi, dealing with what we're dealing with, everybody recognizes that that's the only practical solution to the problem, because it's not going to be Shalom Bayit. And all kinds of things are likely to happen in the absence of the get, and we're concerned with future generations as well. Therefore, the Eitzah HaYeutzah under the circumstances is a get. And that is a matter of what I call Jewish public policy, is what we want to encourage under the circumstances, even though the Baal may be absolutely right that as a matter of Shura Kadim, he has no reason to give a get. Why should he give a get? But you know, the Baal may be right as a matter of halakha. But as a matter of policy, he created status affairs is simply intolerable. And you know, what, clearly what we are looking for, and I do think it was necessary to spell this out, but we are looking for is a situation that would enable the wife to get a get, even in circumstances in which, as far as the Shura Kadim is concerned, is unguided. So we want to create a new set of facts that will make her entitled to it, even if she is. Yes?
So, do you have
it? Do you want to get that or not? I'd rather not, because it's essentially peripheral. Maybe there'll be a little time over left over at the end, because you know, with this case of the you're in your eighth time, it's fine. There's a way of doing that. Extra legal ways of doing that.
I mean, a refined wife.
Sir?
A refined cases of
a recalcitrant husband. All cases of a
recalcitrant
husband? Yes.
Is the point around when you said that any woman says that she doesn't want to be married?
Most of us.
Right.
Yes.
So that's what came out of that. Yes. Then what's the husband?
Right.
And that, I think that's obviously a lot of the right. Then, I mean, if your husband wants to fulfill this topic of right, so if your husband would want to fulfill this a lot of the right, then
yes.
Yes.
Yes. The only people that I know of who are Kesha for most of life are Kemoni.
So they can, not only they can be close, they can't be close because it's my focus.
Right.
But
the positive, yes.
And
we have
his
wife again.
Because
he would
have to worry
if
something was
coming from Mishra Shmadi. No. It doesn't work that way. The Mishra Shmadi Hakam is only the bottom line. Normally, the Halofi is Mishra Shmadi. It's the Hachur of the Bezdin. It's Mishra Shmadi is an actual list. Not just because there's a Machlokes out there and I want to be Chayshish for every sheet in the book. If the hachor of the halacha is that I'm not mechuyev to give her a gift, and there's only mitzvah to give her hachon. Okay, so let me go on to the other proposal. One other proposal that I want to speak about just for a minute or two was not kiddushin al tnai, but something more radical and not dissimilar, and that is that the husband, as soon as they're married, maybe even under the chuppah, if not at least in the yichud room, that the husband be memane a shliach and aiding for purposes of divorcing his wife whenever that becomes necessary, or some modification of that proposal. There, and one gentleman, a Jewish clergyman, even proposed that the wife be appointed as the shliach for her own gift. There are two problems with this. The first problem is the waiver applies to kedushin al tnai applies to the meaning of the shliach. You've got the same problems exactly. The problem of bittul get, bittul shlichus applies there too. Secondly, if you make this contingent upon events that have not yet come
into being, this also involves problems of brera. This, incidentally, was the problem that existed with regard to
Gite no Komo in modern times.
That was the question was asked before, why not use a get al knai for a person who goes to war, and why don't the Israelis do it? Now, the Israelis do it for whatever reason, the Israelis don't do it, but this was done fairly consistently during World War II, but there were problems in World War II that did not exist before. Once upon a time, wars were rather brief and rather bloody. You went to war and you came back, or, for Lila, you didn't come back. But that was the end of it. Only in modern days do you have wars that go on for sometimes interminable periods. And the result is that soldiers get furloughed and they come back home. And this arose, or this was addressed for the first time in England during World War II. The problem was, and they were doing this. A person who went to war, he went to the local Besdin, to the London Besdin, and he was an imam, a shliach, an edim, in case he doesn't come back, the shliach would then be able to execute the get. They didn't enter into the get outside of the Gemara, they did a little bit differently. You know, it was too much trouble. You have hundreds and thousands of soldiers. What are you going to do? Actually write every single get takes too long. So instead of doing that, they would remind the shliach to write the get, whatever. And of course, the shliach wasn't going to write a get as long as the war was still on and while there were still every anticipation that the husband was going to come home. If the husband doesn't come home and we have no body, at that point there's time enough to write the get and deliver it to the wife. The problem with this is that every time the soldier comes home on furlough, there is the problem of people of shlichus. And this was dealt with in a variety of ways. Rav Abramsky, the friend of Lavracha, who was the senior member of the London Bed, for all kinds of purposes, he was the place of the London Bed, maintained that the shoshis of the Gemara did not apply. In those cases, what we are concerned with is that the husband has changed his mind. He doesn't want to give his wife a get, because if he wanted to give his wife a get, what is he doing in the same bedroom with her at night? If he doesn't like her, then what's he here at all for? However, in the case of the soldier, we know very well why he was Meman of Shliach. He was our co-star Shliach, and there's no reason for him to have had a change of heart or change his mind. Therefore, there's no shash that he would be Meman of Shliach. The Chazon Ish wasn't terribly happy with it. The Chazon Ish had a different solution to the problem, a more cumbersome solution. His solution was that, of course, we have all kinds of halachas with regard to the Seder Haget, and we write it in Sava Shuri, in Yiddish Sefer, etc., etc. But in the Eved, any husband could write to get himself, he doesn't need a Sefer. So the Chazon Ish's proposal was that the husband, every time he comes home, should write a new little get in his own handwriting and leave that with the Bezdin to be delivered to his wife, together with the get that he.
Be
modestly at a second time. Sure. Now, how many Dayonim do you think there are in the London Besdin? And
how long does it take to be modestly at? How many soldiers?
Hundreds, thousands of soldiers.
Well, you have to sit down and spend an hour
writing
again.
It takes time. It takes time, and remember that not every soldier is going to do this every time. Therefore, you had problems. And they dealt with the problems, and in whatever way, they dealt with the problems. Now, what implications that has right now is a separate problem. I'm not at all concerned with whatever resolution the Rabbanut and Eretz Yisrael decided to implement with regard to the problems of soldiers in contemporary wars. The next proposal, how many do we have so far? Three. I'm up to four. The fourth proposal involves ways and means of applying a financial penalty. I'll call the fourth proposal the Lieberman Clause because it has several manifestations, and I want to distinguish it from certain other proposals that involve a financial onus of one kind or another. The Lieberman Clause was a provision that was incorporated in the Ksuba endorsed by an organization known as the Rabbinical Sikh Council of America. I'm sorry. Rabbinical Sikh Assembly of America.
And I will read the clause to you. After the standard language of the Ksuba, there is one additional clause which is incorporated. After the phrase that says that the Chosen has accepted the obligations of the Ksuba, and the Chaymer Shtar Supadon Dinin is the Sefnadol Kibel Olof Kassandinan, the Chaymer Korsurik Supas and Sos Vogel Zay Tisor of Sim Tifa Chaymer Zahar Avante, at which point should come the phrase the Likitas of the Lokas Mach, the Likitas of the Shtar Vakol Shor of the Kayom. Instead of that comes the following phrase. I'm also cautious that I'm going to be saying this. Utsviya Mar Pliny Bar Pliny Fasandanan Lamora Pliny Bat Pliny Sultado Lenishpak Dane Lido Vido Ledain Leminho Kolyne Chayehain the Orcho de Iraiso. This is written in impeccable 1st century Palestinian Aramaic. It would warm the cockles of Professor White's heart. The Aramaic is beautiful. The problem is, what does this mean? That's the problem with Aramaic. Note carefully the words. They have each agreed that they will enable the other to conduct himself or herself all the days of their life. Be'orcho d'uraiso, that's an anglicism, in the paths of Torah. Okay. Ki hilche zuvrin yehudoyin, utziviyu birus nafsheyhoin, v'askimu l'kaboa al nafsheyhoin, beizdino dichnishto d'rabonon, chnishto d'rabonon is Aramaic for rabbinical assembly, u'deveis madrisho d'rabonon, that's the Beit Madrasho de Rabbanon, that's the Jewish Theological Seminary, the Arasso de Kayomo. Arasso de Kayomo is Aramaic of Arso Sabris, which is the Hebrew of the United States. Oiman de Ose min Chayle, or anyone who comes with their power, anyone whom they designate. Hechrishu yichido la lofo yasun lemezo burcho deiraiso. They are given authority to teach them la lofo ufan teaching, to teach them how to walk in the paths of Torah. Ulemircham la koro dein ledol vadein ledol ledein. Lemircham ula okora. Lemircham, I sound like honor and cherish, but yeah, I probably translated it. Fine, whatever. Call Yene Negar Nishu'ehain, all the days of their marital life. Vikadilu Anashayin Kokaminoin Larshola Kavre, Lazamola Yose Lemehino Ikarmi Leila, Ikarmi Leila, the aforementioned. To summon each one, to summon the others to appear before the aforementioned Bezdin. If there will be any quarrel between them, for what purpose? So each one of them will be able to conduct himself in accordance with the laws of the very old days of life. They are the Bezdin is now entitled to assess pitsuin. Pitsuin is a financial award. If they will not agree to appear before them, the dino, for purposes of the din, or they refuse to follow the psak din. And all of this, it's signed by the witnesses. You know that a shtar is not signed by the parties in Chayshim Mishtar Ganeza. It's signed by Eidim. There's nothing wrong with this. This is the Ksuba. This is the Ksuba plus the clause. I mean, this is the text of the Ksuba. It ain't all the text. My problem is I purposely read it to you because you have an article that tends to analyze the text in detail. I have problems with it that haven't been raised in the published material. My problem is that as I read it, and pardon me, maybe I can't read Aramaic properly, but as I read it, this essentially binds the parties to conduct themselves b'orcha d'oraisa. It says they're going to be nice observant Jews.
As I read it, it means that if the husband comes home one night and finds a milk spoon with the Slashik silverware, and the wife says, I refuse to kasher, he can now go to the Beidina of the Knishka Rabbanon and say, please tell us, do we have to kasher or don't we have to kasher? If the husband comes home and says, I can't daven Maariv tonight or I can't bench because your sleeves are 2 inches above the elbow, they can now go to the Beidin of the Knishto of the Rabbanon and ask, what's the shear of Tefach B'Sherva? Now, all of these things, these are essentially marital disputes that have some kind of religious component, and you have now bound yourself to go for religious marriage counseling. And the parties have bound themselves to do that, and no more than that. I see no place here any statement with regard to dissolution of the marriage. On the contrary, it says that they are to conduct themselves in accordance with the counsel of this August Din only during the period of Negar Nisu'ein, as long as they are married. Doesn't say anything about terminating the marriage. And Afilu Yisim Tolema, that it means more than that and deals with termination of the marriage, it sounds to me that at most they accepted the jurisdiction of a particular Beis Din to issue a psak of kriya when it's creating a session or a tzaddik. But to go to the Beis Din that doesn't have grounds for kriya, and the Beis Din says, we think it's a good idea if you get divorced, I fail to see how that is subsumed in any of this. You can change everything. I'm just dealing with what's in front of me. In terms of what's in front of me, I don't know what you've gained from all of this. You've gained only cases of Pesachim Reisani anyway, and that is only a small minority of cases of the recalls from husband Nania, that you now would have some way to enforce a get when we don't have the police power to enforce a get that we could enforce in terms of Pesachim Mishpat. Then my problem is, how are you enforcing it? The only way that you can enforce it is by means of imposing these pitsuyim. These pitsuyim this is the crux of the problem. Bezdin can be Tefach Emereisani. Bezdin can't assess a financial penalty when they don't adhere to the structure of Bezdin. That's not the standard form of clear. This provides for what is essentially a knas. It's a penalty clause. The penalty clause has a number of problems, most of which are discussed there. A, in terms of civil law, you cannot enforce penalty clauses. At least the general rule is that penalty clauses are not enforceable. B, penalty clauses in terms of halakha are A and asmachta. They are not enforceable. And therefore, if you try to enforce them in civil law, it's kli shaloted in. It's in halakha, it's gezel, that if I have recourse to a civil court, this is simply extortion. And the result is you have a get melusim, even after they signed this document. And even if you will accept that it's not an asmachta for whatever reason, you're dealing with an insudanatre, self-imposed duress. You can impose direct upon yourself either with a shule or by assuming an enforceable knas in the event that you do not execute the get. Yes. If they have imposed the fine, then the next question is this fine actionable b'dinei Yisrael? If the fine is actionable b'dinei Yisrael, then l'chatzila you shouldn't execute the get at the end of the Ramos Rishon. If this is not valid in Cheshen Mishpah, if you have no right to impose it, then you have exercised a form of illicit kriya, and the get is thoughtful, it's worthless. The get isn't valid. If the reason he's doing it is to avoid the penalty, and the penalty is shaloi kedin, then the get is thoughtful. You've accomplished absolutely nothing. You're a matter of nature's teacher. Yes?
Even if you don't have an unenforceable, the case where you are left at Kopenhagen, you're left in Kopenhagen, the case falls first. It's in any matter of 2 weeks.
Maybe. I'm not sure. And that's the second problem. Whether it's halacha kfiya on the part of Beis Din, what is permitted in terms of kfiya and what is not permitted in terms of kfiya. A strong case can be made for the fact that placing a shachim reisa means kfiya taguf and not seizing property. However, there may be others who would maintain that seizing property is equally valid. But what difference does all of that make? We're not dealing with cases of taking a shachim reisa. That's not going to solve our problem. Clearly this was marketed as a means of solving all the problems. Now, what I can say is that for 25 years, the people who marketed this were careful to keep it out of court. There was no court case that eventually could be decided. That creates all kinds of other problems. People thought it was actionable, and if they executed yet only because they thought it was actionable, is this a get moot? Is this a get moot? That's a separate issue. It gets to court for the first time in what is the case of Aditur versus Aditur. There was a gentleman by the name of Boaz Aditur. He was an Israeli who lived in upstate New York. They entered into a marriage ceremony in which the officiating clergyman used the Lieberman document, and later there was a civil divorce, and Mr. Aditur refused to divorce his wife. She went into court and sued for a get to Das Moshe the Israel to be actually what she sued for was that he go to the Beis Din of the Knishta the Rabbonon and abide by their decision, and it was very clear for the court that the decision will be a get and that he should execute a get. She won in the lower court. The appellate division reversed. The appellate division stated, in effect, that the ksuba is a liturgical document and its provisions are not enforceable by the court of the state of New York. I will not belabor the point and bore you with analysis of what is a liturgical document. I'm not sure what the court meant. It doesn't make terribly much difference because there was another appeals court that ruled on different grounds. A liturgical document could mean either that this is a matter of religion and the courts can't get messed up in this, the First Amendment problem, establishment clause, or it could be liturgical document is like an adhesion contract. It's not a document involving contract, it's a document that it involves a pious platitude. It's a nice, beautiful promise. It's like, I will love and cherish thee. That's not actionable in the court of law, things like that. You can't enforce everything in the court of law. All of this is just a religious rigmarole, and people don't take it seriously. That's maybe what the appellate court meant. I don't know. It doesn't make any difference, because we're beyond that. Yeah?
If you read out the religious report, you take a traditional ksuba. If you were to translate the Aramaic into English, doesn't it look just like a contract? Without the
right? It's absolutely a contract, and arguably enforceable.
Exactly.
Other provisions of the ksuba may be enforceable in the court of law. There's a checkered history in New York and New Jersey with regard to enforce, and Illinois, with regard to enforcing the other terms of the ksuba. And that, there's all kinds of maximinas in other areas. What you're telling me is essentially what a gentleman by the name of Judge Hill said in Stern versus Stern. He had a ksuba that didn't have a Lieberman clause. He read it and he said that this means that you've got to dissolve the marriage to Das Moshe Yisrael whenever Jewish law requires it. He was enough of a Latin to realize that Jewish law doesn't require a divorce, the ksuba doesn't require it, but that the ksuba in effect binds you to lead your entire life, marital life, including dissolution of the marriage, in accordance with Das Moshe Yisrael, which is what the Lieberman clause throws in explicit language. He read it into the old ksuba, and he therefore ordered a get in a case in which there was an allegation of adultery by the husband on the part of the wife. Now, I have several points with regard to Stern versus Stern. First of all, Judge Held reads Aramaic a lot better than I do, because I don't see it here. If I read the ksuba without the Lieberman clause, it says on the Eichir, the Eflach, the Ezer, the Farnes, Yosef, Hilke, Zubin, Yidoi, he obligates himself, Lumeyal, the Reisi, etc., etc. None of that talks about the dissolution of the marriage. You try to read something here as an implied condition, where I don't see that as an implied condition. I promise to do certain things while we marry, but I never said that I was going to terminate this marriage. On the contrary, I expect this to be an eternal union. I don't expect miyoma denat ulola forever.
I expect marriage to be forever. I don't expect to terminate this. But, you know, nonetheless. Then the problem was, yes, and who said that there are grounds for kfiyah even in cases of allegation of adultery? Even when adultery is proved, it's a mahlokes reshining, whether it's kfiyah nishashirim or eitzani, but even there, Tzoril has split with regard to that point. And even if adultery is grounds for kfiyah, you've got to prove the adultery. Some lawyer whispered into his ears, if the husband says that she committed adultery, she is now also to him, and therefore he has to divorce her, he can't live with her in halacha. That's just not, I mean, it's true, but the fact that a person has said, my wife committed adultery, and put that into an affidavit filed with the court in an attempt to gain a civil divorce, if he will come afterwards to the Beis Din with an amashla and will say, sure, I said it. I don't believe it, but I wanted a divorce. I wanted a civil decree. That was my reason for saying it. It seems to me that the Beis Din will say, this is no shadia nashri. This is a valid amashla, and there's no reason to offer you to live with her. So that I have all kinds of problems with Stern versus Stern, not the least of which is, who says that there are grounds for fee in that case? Forget about the other problem.
But it is a contract.
Oh yeah, it's still just a contract. The question is enforceable. Well, that depends. The appellate division in Avitzur would have said that the whole thing is not a legal contract. There are other problems with the Ksuba as a contract. Yes, there are. There are problems. There are a number of problems. The first problem is the parties don't sign it. That's an obvious problem in civil law. That has been overcome in some cases. The next problem is, do they understand it? It's written in a language that the parties do not understand, even if they speak Hebrew. But they're not likely to understand first generation Aramaic. That's the second problem. There are all kinds of other problems. But I mentioned, you know, that's good. So it's a good, we will accept it as a valid contract. Particularly, the further complication is that typically, it depends whether the Mesavah Kiddushin is a Boki Betit Kiddushin, and I hear tell that there are some people out there who are not Boki Betit Kiddushin, and they don't explain the Ksubas of the Chosin. Instead, they give him the English translation, which is printed in all these forms, which has absolutely nothing to do with the Ksubas. Now, if you read the English version, the ksuba is a very mundane instrument. It's not very romantic at all. It doesn't sound right. So somebody went and prepared a marriage contract with a very beautiful text. It sounds lovely. It's just has nothing to do with the ksuba. And that's what they present to the chosin and say, now sign. Now, under those, you know, if this were presented that way to a court of law, no court would ever enforce a ksuba. They got no one was signing. And not only did you present him with a translation that is inaccurate, but a translation that has no relationship whatsoever to the document. That's one of the reasons, among others, why in the Mesavah Kiddushin should present the chosin with an accurate translation of the ksuba, not only the chosin, but the edim too. The edim have to know what it is that they are witnessing, and explain the provisions of the ksuba to the parties in a manner that they will understand, and then you at least have a chance of having it enforced in a court of law. I answer your question. I don't know if you, yeah. Wouldn't he be able to be obligated? Very problematic. First of all, he has no master, there's no shadi in that. Right. No full divorce. And he hasn't alleged adultery. Oh, yes, he does. He alleges he saved himself some alimony. He has a reason to do it. He has a reason to do it. It may not necessarily be decisive, particularly under the new divorce statute. But enough people allege adultery for very good, mundane reasons. Yes. Yes. What if you have a situation in which the husband says, I want shalom bayit? Read any one of the cases in the Pesukei Din Rabbonim where you've got a problem with a divorce. The wife wants a divorce, the husband doesn't want a divorce. He appears before the Beis Din with a Kohen Rabbani, and typically, she's alleging adultery on her part, and he is saying he wants Shalom Bayit. That's the counterfeit. He wants to live happily ever after. We know he doesn't mean it, but that's what he argues, because he doesn't want the Beis Din to force him to give a gift for whatever. He said, that's what the words "I want Shalom Bayit" means. I am ready, willing, and able. It's she who isn't making herself available. I mean, that's typically what he is going to argue. Now, in effect, what you're saying is that if you're dealing with the Baal HaMasareh in this country, who doesn't have a Toyin Rabbi, I need to tell him what to say, and he comes and tells us the truth, he will tell us, I hate her guts. It's just that I want some money, or something else, or I just don't want to give her a gift. And the Besen asks him, and are you ready to go home with her tonight? He'll say, that's the last thing in the world that I want, in which case he's being Minei HaTashmish, and that should be grounds for Tziyah. That makes very good sense, except that the Shach and the Gevurah HaMoshim claims that's not enough to be Minei HaTziyah. You've got the Achrayim. We've got some Achrayim who say that that's grounds for Tziyah, and other Achrayim who say that that's not grounds for Tziyah. Halach HaLamayim. Not for now. They maintain that in itself is not enough for Tziyah Halacha L'maaseh. There may be better grounds for Tziyah in Halacha in most cases. The typical case involves the man who has already either gotten a civil license and remarried, or has set up housekeeping with a live-in friend of the opposite sex without benefit of clergy. That in Halacha is called a Reya Zonis. And Reya Zonis may also be grounds for Tziyah. But let's leave the problems of Tziyah out. Even if we have grounds, how are we going to be kosher? We don't have the means to be kosher. Our problem is to find ways and means that will accomplish the result.
Yeah?
If
you're
still
in the legal court, and then if it takes me to have grounds for both of you take it to a court, then...
And hope the court will enforce it.
Right.
Well, let me finish the abitur. Okay? The Court of Appeals, in a 4-3 decision, enforced the Lieberman Clause. In effect, the majority of the court said, we don't know what this thing means. Go back to the Beis Din and find out. And then, if there are any problems, come back to us. That's how I read the majority decision. There is some debate in the legal community with regard to whether the four-member majority would indeed have enforced a get if the Beis Din had passed in seal. I think that a more conservative reading of the decision, particularly in light of changes that have taken place in the composition of the court, is that in effect they understood that this was a submission to marital counseling and were sending the parties for marital counseling, recognizing very well that this was non-binding arbitration, and the courts of New York enforce agreement for non-binding arbitration. And that's like some people is rather strange, which is why they didn't want to read the Abitur decision that way. Why should you send somebody to arbitration who doesn't have to listen to the arbitrators? Why go through what is essentially a charade? And there are precedents in New York. Of course, in New York do send you for non-binding arbitration. They think that there is some merit to jawboning. Sometimes you can convince the people to do what is right and proper under the circumstances, and if they've agreed to do that, then let them go through the motions at least. I think that in essence that's all that happened in Abitur. Now, that doesn't mean nothing happened in Abitur. I think that's a very significant decision. The problem, the crucial problem with the Lieberman Clause, quite apart from anything I've said so far, is that even if this were fine, wonderful, the problem is that it provides for a Beis Din of the Kanishka de Rabbanan, and that is a Beis Din that by definition has no power to enforce a get, even if there are grounds in Halacha, because the Tiknes HaShem Reis Ani is only if a qualified Beis Din passes clear. If an unqualified Beis Din passes clear, there's no obligation to listen to the Beis Din. Since those individuals are postal agents and postal Medin, there is no way in the world that there can be a valid get pursuant to their decree. But so what? take out the words Behino Beknishta Rabbanon and put in the words Behino Beknishta Rabbanon and say put whatever you want. There is also, I hear tell, although I certainly don't subscribe to the view, there are some people who seem to think that the text of the Ksuba is a halacha Moshe Sinai and it is, improper to tamper with it in any way by adding an additional clause. And if they think so, well, so be it. But that does not prevent us from doing something else. Moreover, there is an appellate division decision that says that a ksuba is a liturgical agreement, and I'm afraid that another court might endorse that view. So for all of those reasons, it seems to me that it would be the better part of wisdom to draft a separate document which is not the ksuba and is clearly not a liturgical agreement, and put into that document an undertaking by the parties to appear before a Beis Din if there is any marital dispute between them. That in effect is a substantive part of the Lieberman Clause, leaving out the Pitsuyim. The Court of Appeals did not enforce the Pitsuyim. It's highly questionable that it would enforce the Pitsuyim. Not questionable, it's impossible. They didn't reach that question. I don't think that any court would substantiate the financial penalty. All you're going to get from the court is specific performance. Don't need to go to the Beis Din, not the financial penalties in any event. The financial penalties present problems. And that this document then in effect simply binds the parties to go to Beis Din. That presents no problems as far as halacha is concerned. The parties are signing an agreement to do what they have to do even without an agreement. If you get a hasmona from a Beis Din, you've got to appear. So that's all that the parties have agreed to do. They've agreed to go to the Beis Din. They bind themselves. Well, what do I gain from a piece of paper? I gain from a piece of paper that the court says, go to Beis Din. Because without the piece of paper, the court doesn't say that you have to go to Beis Din. With a piece of paper, the court says that you have to go to Beis Din. Now, if I am so pessimistic about having the order of the Beis Din enforced by a court, even in case of a fear, then why bother with all of this? Because the courts of the state of New York, in their wisdom, were machaven la mita shel Torah. In the real world, the major part of the difficulty is getting people to appear in the first place. Once you get them to appear, there are ways and means of talking them into doing what you want them to do. It's called the power of moral persuasion. The hardest thing to do is to get the Baal HaMesarev to come to talk to you. When you get him to talk, you can at least engage in a dialogue of one kind or another. You can offer him certain inducements if necessary. You can do other things. Experience teaches that you don't solve all the problems when you meet the party, but you do solve as much as 80% or more of the problems. So what you have in the package, what's it called? An ending up to agreement in wake of Avitzur or what have you. I call it the Avitzur contract, or the Avitzur antenuptial agreement. That is a modification of what the Lieberman Clause was designed to do, pursuant to the decision in Avitzur, and I think no problems with that. However, it certainly is not a panacea. It won't solve all the problems. It will solve some of the problems. Yes.
The Edim were
Pesulim
already in the beginning.
So
what did
she
want to
get?
Who?
Mrs. Abitur. You're sure the Edim were Pesulim?
Well, considering that was the last one that she gave him, the Edim.
And even if there were Edim Pesulim, are you certain that there's no marriage afterwards? That becomes the second problem. That's the first proposal in the package. There are two other documents that I wanted to discuss in some detail. Let me talk about the second proposal, which is another, there's more than one way to skin a cat. What we're looking for, essentially, what Lieberman was looking for, was a penalty for not executing a get. That's really what he wanted. And my post-Avitzur agreement does not provide that penalty. I said it's like the Lieberman clause, that really wasn't accurate. Lieberman thought that the teeth were the between the financial penalty, and it turns out that that's not what it is at all. All that the post-Avitzur agreement does is force the people to appear before the Beis Din. And that's a rather weak remedy. There are other ways of providing for
financial burden such that a person would be happy to give a gift rather than be subject to the financial burden. And you have in the package an article that appears in the Jewish Law Annual. I purposely buried it there because I did not want to give it too much or too wide circulation. It's what I call a provision for faceless mezonos, or if you prefer, so sefet mezonot. It's based upon one basic principle, and that is that while any financial penalty is either outright fear or oins of the nafshe, there is one form of duress that is absolutely permissible in every get, and indeed it exists, or I should say it existed once upon a time, in every case of a get. Why does, or better, why did a husband divorce his wife? Those are two separate questions. If you go out in the street and ask somebody, why does a husband divorce his wife, the answer you'll get is because he met somebody else. He wants to marry some other person. That's the answer that you expect in a society in which polygamy is forbidden. And if you want to marry somebody else, you've got to ditch the first one in order to marry the second one. Before Rabbeinu Gershom, that wasn't the reason that she divorced the wife. You met someone younger, prettier, a better cook, you could take a second wife. You didn't have to divorce the first one to marry the second one. The more the merrier. You have a few more wives. The reason that a husband divorced his wife before Rabbeinu Gershom was that share, ksus, and or una of multiple wives was just too much. He is divorcing his wife because he wants to rid himself of the obligations vis-a-vis wife number one. You have a woman who is constantly clamoring for a mean coat, or even if she's not clamoring for a mean coat, she wants at least a decent meal three times a day, and his husband doesn't want to provide her with decent meal three times a day. Bread and water, he thinks, should be enough for her. But what can he do if she slips into the Beis Din, and the Beis Din says, yeah, she's entitled to some meat and potatoes also, but he doesn't want to give it to her. So the only remedy is to call the sefer and he didn't give her the divorce, because otherwise the Beis Din wouldn't have the chayav mezonos. He's got to support her as long as he's married. There is one way to get rid of the chayav mezonos. It's called a get. Now clearly this man's motives are financial. That's not called ksiv. Because the elimination of obligations that flow from a marital relationship is what it gets all about. That cannot be construed as clear for the get itself. Yeah? Fine. Step number two. I know of no reason why a husband cannot obligate himself to a level of support and maintenance which exceeds that provided by Ebenezer. I'll try to do it very quickly. In fact, I have a source for it. I have a source that in halacha there is such an obligation, that we can enter into such an obligation. My source is a rational information. Yitzchok is sick, and Yitzchok wants some food, so he calls Esau, and he says, Seidoli, Dai, says Rashi, that he tells Esau to go and shoot to bring Miha Esker. He's worried about Esau, he doesn't want him to go steal, so he tells him, Seidoli, Dai, bring Miha Esker. Esau goes out to go catch some animals, and Rivka calls in Yankiv, and she tells Yankiv to go bring food to the father. But Yankiv can't go hunt. She doesn't know how to hunt. So what does she do? She gives him two Gidoi Izim. Rashi gives you a carriage to not ask a question. Rashi is bothered. It's like it's a significant problem. Yitzchok did not want to squander his own animals. He's keeping his animals for whatever. He doesn't want Gezel to be sure, but he's sending Esau to the Lisai. He's got flocks. Why does he send to check one of his own animals? The answer is he wants his animals for whatever. He wants their milk. He wants their wool. Who knows what he wants? And there are plenty of animals out there. Let Esau go hunt and bring me an animal in a hefker. And here is risk in effect stealing from Yitzchok. Answers Rashi to this unasked question. I don't know of any human being that can possibly consume two animals in a day. I know that under some circumstances, depending upon the socioeconomic level of husband and wife, a husband may conceivably be obligated to provide his wife
with kosher filet mignon three times a day, if there is such a thing, but not more than she can eat three times a day. I mean, what kind of level is the pagan? So Yitzchok's a wealthy man, and she's entitled to meet three times a day. Steak in the evening. How can she eat steak in the evening? The answer is that he gave her a place of Mazinus Mitzvah. He was telling her that every day she gets Sukkot Yizim. What she's supposed to do with Sukkot Yizim? Either she sells them each day and saves the money and buys herself a mean coat, or she gives it to Sukkot, she gives it to Amin, and he's giving her whatever, you know, her allowance so that she can dispense charity without consulting him. Whatever's going on there, but she is clearly getting an allowance per diem from Yitzchok, and it's not Gezel, which means it's not Nesmachta. It means she was entitled to it Mitzad Adin, and she is collecting what she's entitled to Mitzad Adin. Now, I don't have time, but I just have to be carefully formulated in terms of how you draft this. Clearly, a situation which a husband says that when there will be a civil divorce, you will get from me an allowance of $250 a day, that's the category of a smasher. The husband never, as soon as there's going to be a civil divorce, he doesn't anticipate the breakdown of the marriage. That is not actionable. Read the article. The old way that this will work is if it has nothing to do with divorce, but it is an obligation on the part of the husband to an enhance level of support and maintenance during the life of the marriage, so long as it is recognized as valid in the eyes of Jewish law. Now, for a number of reasons, you don't want to do this. You don't want to create a situation in which a wife is entitled to $250 a day from the day of the chuppah, because then you'd have a new kind of chap who gets married in anticipation of divorce. She'll let the clock run for a month. $250 a day for 30 days, a lot of money. Then she sues for divorce, and look, she's collecting all this money. The answer to that is two. A, there's a provision, Shulchan Aruch in her Nebnezer. If a woman doesn't claim Mizaynus, there's a presumption of Mechilin for the days gone by. If a woman has not received adequate food from her husband one day, she can go to the bed the next morning and they will award her steak and potatoes and whatever else for that day, but not for the day before. There's a presumption of Mechilin unless and until you've appeared before the bed. I believe that the presumption of the Mechilin extends to Tosfos and Mizaynus as well. And if it doesn't, make it explicit. Write it in. And if you don't like that, then there's a simple way of dealing with it. I think you have to deal with this for other reasons anyway. And that is that you have to create an agreement in which the wife is given an option. She is told that she's entitled to $250 a day, $500 a day from the beginning of the marriage for support and maintenance whenever she claims it. Or, in lieu of that, she can have her orange juice and Rice Krispies in her husband's kitchen. In other words, she gets either the per diem or mizonot al shulchano, but not both. What is the effect of this? It means that as long as there is shalom bayit and she's still in the marital abode, she's not going to be able to claim cash. However, when she feels compelled to move out of the marital habitat, she has an automatic claim for $250 a day, which she can also claim whenever they go on separate vacations. And it's got to be spelled out that she has this right whenever she wants it. Then you create a situation in which whenever there is a breakdown in the marital relationship, the husband has an incentive to divorce the wife. In effect, you have created a situation in which the wife is entitled to a divorce on demand, because no sane husband is going to allow the clock to keep running, and as long as the meter runs, it's going to cost them a lot of money. Now this may lead to precipitous divorce. I tried to deal with that by making provision for an obligation only when she is mukhevet minasei matei, meaning where he is the impediment to her ability to remarry, which would effectively mean that he's willing to deposit a get with Beis Din to be delivered to the wife whenever she wants it. Then Beis Din could still attempt to effect a reconciliation if that is in the cards. And now all of these are things that have to be spelled out a great deal with a great deal more care. We simply don't have time for all of that. I see you have a question. Yep. Let me just summarize this very, very quickly. The advantage of this proposal is that A, it has absolutely nothing to do with divorce. Divorce isn't mentioned. There's no reason to mention divorce. And it involves a matter which seems to me is not a penalty, hence is enforceable in court and in a civil court, and it's not going to be part of the ksuvah. On the contrary, Chodesh is also in favor. Thank heaven for small mercies. I went looking and I found Yagati Umotosu.
You better believe it. I went looking in the Nakashiva and I found that there was an institution once upon a time called Tanoim Acharonim. Our Tanoim are Tanoim Rishonim. This ancient and venerable institution of Tanoim Acharonim has fallen into disuse. I think it's a terrible thing this is. Once upon a time, there was a second document that was drafted right before the Chuppah. Not the Tanoim that some people play around with today. Instead of doing it way before, they do it before the Chuppah, for better or for worse. But before the Chuppah, they had a new document which in effect said that the parties had fulfilled their obligations under the original Tanoim, and this eliminated any future Sifzuch, any future Dinterah. The Chuppah comes and says, you didn't give me my Nazim and things of that sort. You eliminated all of that by ensuring that there was a kind of a release that was drafted right before the ceremony. Now, included in this, I found, was an additional obligation. It read, in part, that if, for some reason, the woman will find it impossible to remain under the same roof as her husband, then he obligates himself to blank number of zehudim b'chol shavua ad shiyamdu l'din v'alpiyem yekol rizvah omega. The husband promises to give his wife so many gold coins a week whenever she leaves the house, until such time as they appear before the bezdin. When you get the bezdin, the bezdin decides what they have to do. Now, that's not maksim. It's a problem, a serious problem. So you look in the footnotes of the editor of the Nachashiva, he says that this was part of Hakonas Shum. It was an Hakonah of the Kihilis. That takana is no longer extant. Now, we're not really in the business of promulgating new takanas. In effect, what this is simply reviving the Tanoim Acharonim instead of calling it a takana. I should say calling it. Instead of promulgating it as a takana binding upon everybody, it becomes a unilateral undertaking on the part of the groom, the bosom, and it becomes binding as a result of his contractual undertaking. It becomes a form of support and maintenance which is as actionable as those Tanoim Acharonim of Kehilas Shum. There's another proposal in the package. There's no time to talk about it anymore. Yes? Not really. The answer is yes. Let me say straightforward yes. The major objection to what I'm doing is that we have created a situation where instead of, as is the din midoraisa, a husband can divorce his wife against her will, we have a situation in which a woman can get a get against the will of her husband. She can force the husband to divorce her whenever she wants the divorce. That is absolutely true. I plead guilty with an explanation, Your Honor. My explanation is that I really have a choice. Either I give the woman the right to do this, or I'm confronted with problems of mamzerut. Take your pick. Which do you want?
I don't know.
Have I did an affair?
Yes.